This show is a part of the FM Podcast Network, the home of great music podcasts. Visit us at fmpods.com.
Welcome to Infinity Goes Up on Trial. Today I'm with Dr. Court Carney, who's a professor of history at Stephen F. Austin University, where he teaches courses on Black history and American cultural history. He's a founding member of the Teaching Woody Guthrie Collective, and his first book is Cuttin' Up, How Early Jazz Got America's Ear. We co-edited a book on Bob Dylan's set list called The Politics and Power of Bob Dylan's Live Performance, Play a Song for Me. And he's a forthcoming book where he will be a guest on the show in the future to talk about his book, Reckoning with the Devil, Nathan Bedford Forrest in Myth and Memory. Welcome, Court.
Hi.
This is going to be a really...
I don't know what to do. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. I mean, we probably should have filmed this at Common Bond in Montrose. For those of you who don't know, Court and I work together frequently, and we're fairly good friends. And so this is enjoyable for me, but it might be one of the less serious conversations we have.
I wasn't prepared for the small talk.
You weren't prepared for... I'm so sorry. Should I have given you no small talk here?
Maybe.
Okay.
I'm good.
So
I'm focused.
We just got back from a conference in Odense, Denmark. It was the conference Bob Dylan, Questions on Masculinity, and Court and I were both keynote speakers. I was so glad to hear your paper. But I want to talk first about your social media posts, because you put, that face. You put that it was transformative, both personally and professionally. And I want to tell you that before I saw your post, I used the same word, transformative, in an email to a friend. And so there was something very special that happened on that trip. We weren't on it, obviously, the whole time together. I started in London, you went to Sweden, and you were on sort of a honeymoon with your wife. It was quite lovely. But why was it such a special trip for you? What resonated?
You write things, and you say things like it's transformative, and then you have to answer texts and emails and one-on-one conversations
right.
being filmed. But why was it transformational? But it was transformational. I think that word just came easily to me. And I think that this trip ended up happening right at a moment, or actually after a year of very deep sort of resonant changes. And going into this trip and the work I was doing is part of it, but then there's also this kind of personal story I'm involved in, and with myself and with relationships and with friends. And I think it was all these different things. If you look at the last year, it's been a year of immense change. And instead of being, I think, part of that as much, it was a distillation of all of that. And I think going into it in terms of the paper I wrote, and coming out of it in terms of the friendships that were deepened and made, I think it was all part of this kind of transformational moment. So I stand behind anything I say on social media is very serious and must be broadcast with.
And examined and analyzed.
Yes.
I think similarly, I think I've said this to just two people. When I was on the flight, I learned that a friend of mine had passed away. And from April 2018 until my grandmother passed away in December 2022, it's just, we suffered so much loss. And I remember we were talking about that in one of the conversations, how much loss Dylan experienced, pretty much in terms of your paper. And it contextualized that for me. And I was looking so forward to this trip, and I thought, this is going to be framed now by another loss. And when I got to London, I met up with Roberta, who's just such a lovely and warm person, and Michael, and we went to breakfast, and I said, the first thing I want to do is go to the Yoko Ono exhibit. And that exhibit reframed my entire trip, and it changed my mindset that I think my friend Lizzie would have wanted it to be more of a celebration and an opening of, like, you know, being open to those relationships, like you're saying. And so it really, I was so nervous that I was going to be so heavy the whole trip, because I cried most of the flight. But once I landed, and Yoko invited us into that exhibit to write a wish, and I wrote something, you know, in general, but it was really with Lizzie in mind, and then I went through. And so it's similar to you, like, I've been on my own personal journey, but then being with all of those people really opened up just new things for me intellectually and personally, and it was just really lovely. So speaking of that, tell me about your paper that you presented, which is just lovely.
Here's real stuff.
Here's real stuff.
Now here's, what about your paper?
I just said though, I mean, your paper and the realization that I had is like, once I put it together that your paper was so deeply personal, but you were looking at Dylan through that lens, I went back to the other work of yours that I know, and I thought, I can kind of see that deeply personal court in those pieces, which makes your work so beautiful for me.
Well, I appreciate that. I think there is a very long story here of never quite being able to define what I do in a way that made sense to the boxes that professions required. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is that I had a master's thesis on Civil War memory. I had a PhD dissertation on jazz in the 20s. And I think those two things seemed like very separate paths. And when you're a graduate student, or when you're an early, you know, non-graduate student professor, you're so desperate to try to make sense, have people make sense of you. And those things never cohered in a way to others. And it was, I think that it took me a long time to kind of understand how they were connected. And I think it's taken me up until this point in my life to kind of say that they are connected. Now, there's another part of me that says it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But I think that these are all deeply connected to how I view the past and how I view the present, really, just in terms of how people make sense of themselves. So whether it's memory in terms of how people are constructing their vision of the past and how they fit into it, or it's music and how people are connecting themselves to the music and why it matters to them and how that has a resonance and meaning beyond that, I think it's all part of the same story. With Denmark, and I cannot remember when I first heard about the conference. It might have been a year ago.
It was probably right somewhere after World of Dylan, because Emery and I kind of hatched the idea at World of Dylan.
And we're at a year since
that. Yeah, we're
about
that, a year like since
week.
Then.
So,
and I'd mentioned it to you, and you said, I think I've got something for that. And I mentioned it to Emery, and she said, would he be a keynote? And I said, I think we could make that happen.
Well, I didn't know what to do.
Right.
That's the whole thing. Dylan and manhood, and so here's the story, and I don't know, not to rehash the entire paper, but the paper itself...
It's a great paper.
The paper itself was looking at, primarily it was using Johnny Cash and Jerry Garcia to look at this kind of question of brotherhood, and superficially right. That's what it is about, but it never really was about that. And to get to the other point, I kind of created this taxonomy of his male friendships and relationships, at least in the early period. And I don't, yes.
I was going to ask, what is the taxonomy?
Because well,
yes. Not everybody was in Denmark. And part of the reason we're talking ahead of your Nathan Bedford Forrest episode is that people have reached out and asked for a recap of Denmark. So this is kind of what this is.
Yeah, so the first part of the presentation was basically saying, how do we create a map of his male relationships early on? And so I came up with this kind of three-part thing. It was mentors, which is fairly easy, and brothers, which was fairly easy, mm-hmm. but trickier. And then I was kind of thinking there are these groups of men, who don't fit into that. And that's where I came with this idea of the gunslinger. So it's like mentors, gunslingers, and brothers. Mentors are easy. It's people like Woody, people like Ramblin' Jack, people who, Van Ronk, who were like Mike Seeger, kind of showing him the way. Mm-hmm. Brothers were easy because I really wanted to talk about Jerry Garcia and Johnny Cash, who I think are brought into that world, but then you also have his own brother, David Zimmerman, and you also have George Harrison, who I think is a huge asterisk here, and that became the whole Q&A of that.
I was just going to say, who wound up talking about George for 45
Harrison
minutes
became,
afterwards?
Yeah. But the Gunslingers, I think, is actually kind of the interesting middle group, because those are people like Mike Bloomfield, those are people like Bobby Newirth.
Robbie Robertson,
people who were sort of... they're all guitar players. Mm-hmm. Well, not all guitar players, but they involved the guitar players, but they also involved his sort of, you know, Bobby was with him throughout all of that scene, right. And he's sort of his
partner in invective, kind of, right?
Yeah. And I think that's interesting that he needs these people to kind of bounce off of. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a little bit more of a cynical take in terms of these are also people who, at least on some level, were on his payroll. And there is that element of it. Mm-hmm. But I think there is something here that these are people who might have defined themselves as brothers to Dylan, but I don't know if Dylan would have reciprocated that so much.
Right.
But I want to be clear.
More so with Robbie, too, right?
I want to be clear here. I'm not trying to create fast rules here or saying you're in or you're out. It was more trying to create a landscape of who are these relationships and why are these relationships important. Mm-hmm. And to get to your earlier point, what I began to realize when you're looking at Johnny Cash, Jerry Garcia, New Earth, Robbie, George, they're all gone.
Right.
The only two people of this entire group of characters is his own brother.
Right.
And Ramblin' Jack. And so It struck me that when we're talking about mentors and mentees, we're also talking about Bob Dylan standing here in 2024 with just immense amounts of loss. Mm-hmm. That these are all people, and the part of the whole story of my paper was using the eulogies specifically of Garcia and Cash. And it's like, yeah, these are not just people that he had relationships with, these are people that define incredible loss. And none of this is to speak for him at all, mm-hmm. but it was this kind of, this concept of like, wow, that's kind of striking that, you know, how do we create this landscape? I want to be clear here. This is like when we did the set list book, this is like finding out all the times he played a certain song
right.
and you spend 6 weeks looking at all this kind of stuff. And then that is a footnote.
Right.
But that was kind of the way I started the process of thinking about it. But none of that's really what the paper is about. Mm-mm. And I don't think that was conscious to me until very late in the game. And I think that was sort of the, if you asked me in January what I was doing, I would have said something like that.
Right.
And then when it got to April, and I was like, And I was like, oh.
TikToks.
PowerPoint coming due. I was thinking, well, there's something else going on here. And I knew something else was going on here. And then the strategic point I made, error or otherwise, was that I decided to flip the script. And then I started saying that this is why I'm talking about this. Mm-hmm. And I think that those opening remarks were not as set in stone as other parts of it. And I think that's the part that I was like, I'm just gonna go with it.
Right.
Because I think there's something, because the main part of all of this is not brotherhood, but it's vulnerability. And if there was a way to define what I was talking about more than anything else, it's actually trying to figure out my connection to Dylan and why certain parts of his career, certainly the music, but why are there certain parts that really magnetize me to him? Like, what about it is so interesting?
All right, so what are those parts? That's my question.
Well, that's kind of the thing. And so the joke, the punchline, so my therapist says, you know, you're using humor to deflect. I'm like, that's crazy. It's 50 years of... But then you realize that you've used humor to deflect.
Right.
But the deflection is that, what's the thesis statement? The thesis statement is Jerry Garcia hugging Bob Dylan.
Right.
There's a couple of images.
I'm going to link that photo. If you'll send it to me, yeah. I can put it in the show notes so people can see what you're talking about, because it's a beautiful photo.
It's a great photograph. It's just off of off the stage, and it is, I think we have at least two frames of it. Mm-hmm. One of which is just Jerry beaming. Just, you don't see Dylan. You,
right.
This is what's so beautiful with the photograph. You just see Dylan's back, and you see Jerry Garcia beaming, like this beautiful smile. And then the second photograph is you just see Jerry's arms, like mm-hmm. it's just like this beautiful bear hug.
Right.
Which you don't see that often in terms of like Dylan, right? You don't. There's not too many images like that. And I was like, well, that's the thesis statement. But then I was like, you know, that really is the thesis statement. That's the moment that you're like, why is this meaningful? And I think that we can dig into this psychologically or historically, but there is something there in the sense of like that image was like, okay, this is why I connect to that. But then you start realizing, it was like, well, you know, Jerry will be gone within 6 weeks or something like that. Yes. Like, it's near the
in
end
95.
Of Jerry's. Yeah, it's the end of Jerry's life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you could spend a long time just devoting yourself to the energy in that photograph. But then what I think about, and this is where I got kind of sidetracked, is that there, I remember when Get Back came out and Peter Jackson's reconfiguring of the Let It Be sessions. And the trailer dropped, and the trailer has a scene where Ringo and John walk out arm in arm. And I was so touched by that. And there was a flurry of texts between friends of mine. It was just like, did you see it? Like, it's like this beautiful image of these two guys in their late 20s being, you know, cordial to one another. And I don't want to get into all of that, but it was like, why is that so moving? Why is that so meaningful? Why is that so heavy? And it was the same thing that was going on with this too. And I think that that was then the entry point of understanding it's not so much Bob Dylan's vulnerability, which I'm not in any space or desire even to question. It's what about these moments move me, and why do I find myself connected to this concept so strongly, which, as your viewers may probably have no concept of, I don't have a brother. I'm an only child. I don't have a relationship that is like, oh, that's mirroring that. And I don't have anything like that. And I'm also someone who has sort of spent their life trying not to be so vulnerable. So then why is vulnerability and brotherhood the basis of what I find the most meaningful element of all this? And that was sort of like what I was trying to figure out.
Right. It's interesting. There are two pathways that lines of questioning. One, I just talked to Elizabeth Katalamasa, and we were talking about the fact that Dylan uses humor as a deflection. And so there's something, maybe what you're recognizing, you know, from 1965 press conference or interviews, the way that he does kind of maneuver around answering questions or being vulnerable through similar methods that you have used. And then you see this beautiful picture where there's an absolute expression of emotion there that he is letting, there isn't that same level of humor or you know, use of language to mask whatever it is.
Or
It's a
genuine moment, and there's also a genuine sense of maybe even, certainly from what we see with Jerry, just
right.
Maybe joy.
Yeah, because we don't see Dylan's face. We see
unguarded,
right.
Yeah. No, there's something to that. And I think there's an idea of like deflection. First of all, funny can just be funny.
Right.
I will stand behind that. But there's also this idea
fair.
Of like self-creation and this idea of how do you create a persona of yourself. And this idea, and this is what came up in the conference a lot, is like, you know, wearing masculinity or wearing manhood as a posture, as a costume, is very much of what is a part of the Dylan story. And, you know, there is really great papers that were talking all about that. And that's not my thing so much, but it resonates.
Right.
And I think that's what the personal story was going on, that was rattling me in a way that 10 years ago, I would have just pushed aside. And at this stage of my life, after the year or so that I've been dealing with, I don't mean dealing with as like a tragedy, it's also just reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, well, let's not have that be pushed aside. Let's investigate why that's so meaningful.
Right. It's interesting too, because there's an article that I read somewhere in my education by a scholar named Lira Medavoy about the misogyny of rock and roll. And we can say that there's misogyny, obviously, in rock and roll, that maybe when you see that posturing of masculinity that rejects or pushes it back against femininity or feminine qualities in that way, that when you see a hug or you see that vulnerability or you read the eulogies, I wanted to get back to the eulogy because he uses the word brother for Jerry. That he feels he lost a brother. And so there is a softness there that we're not used to seeing, that it lets us in some way.
What's so beautiful about that eulogy, also, he says he's like an older brother.
Yeah, but he's younger.
Yeah, but he was the older brother who taught him
these
things. And now there is the larger piece here, because I don't want, you know, this is not the be all end all of what I'm interested in. What I'm interested in a larger scale has to do with, I shouldn't say that, but something I'm going to be working on, that I'm focused on, is the idea of Dylan sort of interrogating the past. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where Garcia is important too. So these old folk songs, these old murder ballads or whatever, that I think in some ways he does learn from Garcia. Mm-hmm. I think is important. But I think there's something else that's going on too, in terms of like that language that he's using. And he's using a lot of cosmology too. Like mm-hmm. There's all this talk about the sun and the stars.
And yeah.
He does that with Harrison too. Mm-hmm. And Johnny Cash.
Yeah.
But why is that so powerful? So
speaking of the taxonomy, you have gunslingers, you have mentors, brothers. Are there any classifications you'd include?
Frenemies?
Frenemies? Who are the frenemies? No. Phil Oakes?
I think the sons, you mentioned sons.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it's basically who is he mentoring, which he doesn't, right? I mean, that's kind of a...
No. But I mean, would you include Tony in that?
Well, that's the asterisk, right?
Right.
There's people like Tony. There's people like he's worked with. There's people like Bono. There's people... Mm-hmm. I think the one person that came up in conversation that I do think would probably fit into was like someone like Jack White, who
yeah.
has his own sort of trajectory that is built around the same sort of blocks.
Mm-hmm.
That was a Lego joke that brings us back to both Scandinavia and videos.
But and my weird experience at the Copenhagen airport too, the giant talking Lego. Did I send you that picture?
No.
Oh, I will.
So I don't know. I think there's something to that. I think it would take someone who's much more versed in some of these relationship dynamics
right.
to talk about. But I do find it interesting. And I found it interesting. Basically, the story I was trying to tell is that it's in these moments that you could then insert yourself in a way that I found sort of fundamentally moving.
Right.
And I think that's what it is. It's not so much about anything about him necessarily. Which so often that's not the question, but it's.
No, I'm just.
What it does for you.
No, I'm just kind of thinking that it's interesting because I do have a thought for that, but, and maybe this isn't going to resonate in the same way for you, but, if he's in a paternal role and that's a masculine performance or performance of masculine identity, if we say sons, then are there daughters, in that conversation then? Like someone like Fiona Apple or Joan Osborne, or are there also daughters that we can say maybe he's not maybe he's mentoring?
Oh, I think there's probably some mentoring. Yeah, no, I guarantee there is. And I think
right.
this is also the thing that's interesting is thinking about that's at different times.
Right.
I was trying to be very specific to the early period just because I was trying to draw some firm lines. But if you
right.
get past that, there's all sorts of things that are going on that I think are interesting. And there's also a lot of stuff that's probably not as well known. That's
mm-hmm.
not as public. I'm thinking in particular, like when he starts moving into that elder statesman period,
yeah.
you know, wherever you want to date that, late 80s into the 90s, that's a very different sort of world, and we didn't see much of that world. It was not as public. And what you were talking about too is like there's the whole private scene of him in 67 and 68 and 69.
Right.
You know, it's hard to gauge some of that. And I think that
because most of what comes from that is what Robbie is saying, right? We get a lot of Robbie's perspective of that. And
right.
So much his.
And I think, yes. And there's some conversations we've had recently that we want to be clear that these are people who have certain perspectives
right.
that may not also be the same as what happened.
Right, right.
But
I wonder though what resonates with you is that sort of that vulnerability that allows you to have relationships, that you're witnessing a relationship developing, or that it's like a snapshot of that relationship and to have that true connection. That's what I was really getting to, was connection between two people that we respond to. And I'm not saying like we just as you and me, we as human beings, we can recognize, you know, when people are connecting with each other in a fundamental way.
I think that's true. And I think back, like, I was trying to think about, you said something earlier of like, you know, where do I connect to him? And I think of like, you know, what are the moments in his career that I find the most moving? And those change. Mm-hmm. I think when I was in grad school, I don't think you could have pushed me off of the 66 stuff. Like that was
right.
that was the epitome for me. And then in my, you know, this is gonna be shocking and this is so surprising to people. In your 30s, all of a sudden Blood on the Tracks is like the only meaningful record that, that exists. Yeah. But why?
Groundbreaking.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you're like, what? What? But I think there's something interesting to that of like, you know, not only do the moments change, but then what are the moments that don't change? Like like your favorite Dylan moments or performances are the ones that kind of give you a lot of meaning. And I'll tell you right now that there are songs that are sort of concretized in my mind with him that I wouldn't say are necessarily my favorite songs, but in some ways they have to be. And that's like Boots of Spanish Leather, which I could... you know, my favorite songs in the world are songs that I love to such a degree that I couldn't tell you one thing about them. Walk Away, Renee. Moves me to tears every time. What's it about? I don't know. I don't know. But I love that song to death.
Right.
Boots of Spanish Leather. You know, there's a narrative void in there that it's very difficult quite really to kind of connect with. But, I mean... Mama, You've Been on My Mind. That's a song that is very deeply meaningful to me. And I'm not saying that those were his greatest, but I think those have emotional resonance to me. And we all have those connections. Mm-hmm. But then what's about those? You know, there's a reason why you find him so interesting academically or from a historian's perspective. But there's also just the reality of what moves you. And I think going back to the larger story here is that there's been a long period of like where you have to kind of separate those two, or one's not as interesting as the other. And I think I kind of gave up on that on this last thing. So in the last year, you know, I finished the book I've been working on for a long time, which we're going to talk about later. I was kind of in between big projects. I was sort of dealing with my own level of loss and complexities of life and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, you know, I'm just not interested in kind of trying to tether this to something more uniquely academic. And I was more interested in sort of using it as an exploration of how do we connect to music emotionally and with vulnerability. And why people, that's what's interesting too, someone like Johnny Cash, who is sort of a stoic in so many ways, but that he's so wounded, and then that's the entry point, right? It's
right.
Like these are wounded people, and the wounding, and the unwounding, and the infinite kind of rewounding. That's it, and it's kind of like, oh, okay. It's not about being real or not real, because I don't think that's really the question you ask with Dylan in particular.
Yeah.
But it is like, you know, how do these wounded people sort of continue to create such meaning out of all of this? And there's a way to romanticize that can be very toxic. And there's also a way to realize, well, you're wounded. And so you recognize these moments. And none of this is exceptionally novel. But I think being able to tap into that was important to me. And I think that what Denmark did then was his transformational, was not just transformational in terms of seeing an area that I've always wanted to see, but it was also transformational because of the professional and the personal sort of blurring in ways that were expected, but then in ways that weren't.
I think that's why I wanted to talk with you. I mean, obviously we're friends and I like talking with you, and I find you inspiring, and I'm always intrigued by your work, and it does inspire me in my own work, and I'm grateful to you for that. But that idea of vulnerability and connection to me encompassed sort of, or embodied the whole experience of being in Denmark and Oons with those people and sharing ideas. But we didn't just share ideas, that experience was just so beautiful that I feel, you know, it was almost dreamlike in a way. And so what was the highlight of the conference for you?
Well, I think the coward's answer is all of it, but it was summer camp, right? It was summer camp of people. I knew about 80% of the people going in.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked all the people I knew going in, mm-hmm. but I didn't know all of them all that well.
Right.
And there are people that came out of that that I feel very close to that I felt just admiration for ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are the people that you didn't know that were sort of brought into our circle a bit.
Yeah. I know, I saw Andrew come in the first morning and I thought, here's a kid, he's young. And I said, okay, we all know each other. I said, all but two of the presenters know each other, and most of the people in the audience know each other. So I said, you know, I learned he was from Boston, introduced him to Paul, and I said, just stay with us. And he fits so seamlessly into that group that kind of moved around together. I was really grateful for that.
Yeah, I know those are all the great things but it seemed like deeper than that too, though. It wasn't just that we all had a good time. I think we all did have a good time. It wasn't all we were kind of exploring a new space. That's interesting too, because if this was like in Philly or mm-hmm. you know, something like that, that'd been a different world. The fact that we were in this space, that we were sort of figuring it out on our own together,
mm-hmm.
That everyone was in some form of travel, that people's trips there or everyone was going someplace else afterward.
It
was
like, okay,
yeah, it was like this whole thing. I think that puts people in a different space. You know, for me, there's also so about a year ago, not quite a year ago, I was standing in the Nordic Museum, which is in Seattle. And it's amusing because for a slew of reasons, but I had been there before. And for some reason, I just liked it and I wanted to go back. And I went back, and that was this epiphanic moment, because what happened in the Nordic Museum, as silly as it sounds, kind of put me on this path. And I think that a year ago this year actually led me down these series of roads. And nothing more particular than, why do I feel connected? And this is, again, to your viewers and listeners, you know, not only does he not have a brother or a sister, but he's adopted.
Mm-hmm.
So I did not know my birth family. Actually not true, but I knew very little of it. I knew none of it until about 7 years ago, and I only knew half of it until recently. And standing in the Nordic Museum, wondering, what is the connection here? And I was like, what is the connection? What is the connection? What is the connection? What is the connection to Seattle? What is the connection to this place in a way that I've never really felt connected to any space? And this is where the chair goes back a little bit and it becomes a thinking couch. But that was very much part of it. It was like, and this goes back to the Dylan story. It's like, okay, why am I so profoundly moved by that early, not the early song so as much as like the early period? Because I think one of the most moving interviews we have is the Scorsese No Direction Home.
Mm-hmm.
And those early interviews of him when he's talking about how cold it was and we didn't have the right clothes. We didn't have clothes mm-hmm. like we have now. And it was like,
talking about layers. And
Yeah. It's a real practical thing. But it's also this really interesting, deep sort of No Direction Home. It's like you've talked a lot about the idea of like, how does it feel? It's right there in Technicolor, but mm-hmm. we miss the idea of what, how does it feel actually
right.
is the,
I can't claim that.
Thesis
Jason gave
thing.
It to me. Yeah.
Who?
Jason, my first guest.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
it's my citation.
You mention it.
It's my citation.
Yes. Your citation.
Yes.
Footnote 8.
My 47 footnotes.
But I think there's something to that. Like, it's like you can hear, how does it feel 10,000 times and go, oh wait, no, that's actually, how does it feel?
Right.
It's like the No Direction Home. No Direction Home. Okay. Oh, wait. No Direction Home.
But the first thing, he says, I was born very far from where I'm supposed to be, and I'm on my way home. And you're just like, and then it cuts to the music. And if you're not paying attention, it goes by.
But that there's that.
Right.
And there's also then the song that means a lot to me, too, Song to Woody,
mm-hmm.
which is very much, I didn't even talk about any of this because I didn't think I needed to, but this whole idea of like, you know, 1,000 miles from my home.
Did you feel like you didn't need to because you knew everyone in the room and you thought that we'd heard that before, we'd read the chapter in the set list book, or did you not include it because you didn't think it needed to be part of the argument?
I'll be very honest with you.
Yes. Please
you've
do.
Seen me present several times.
Yes.
And I'll be honest, and you're gonna find this surprising to hear.
You're gonna hear it here first.
I have a very good idea of what I wanna say. I don't always have it written down or timed. And so there is a... There is a sense of performative or performance art, if you want to be pretentious, but also there's a little bit of performative element where it's like, if I can get in the headspace of knowing what I want to do and how I want to do it, and I did know from the plane certainly on what I wanted to do. Right. I knew the parentheses.
Right.
But I was like, oh, do I want to get sidetracked on that? And but so I didn't want to go that direction.
Side note, that is one of the things I admire most about you, because you have this ability to speak extemporaneously in the most brilliant way that you've seen. I have notes, and you're always saying in all caps, you'll text me, you are prepared, because I need to be. Otherwise, my anxiety takes hold of me. I feel like everything I'm saying is stupid. And you saw that moment in Denmark when I almost dropped all of my papers. Court fixed my computer. We can talk about you as my computer savior. I almost dropped my papers, and I made a joke. I said, that would have been a disaster, because I would have lost it. I would probably wouldn't have been able to finish after that. But you just, like, you come out, and you know an outline of what you say. You have 47 footnotes. You're like, this is, and you just do it, and it's brilliant.
Well, I appreciate that. I would say, though, that it's not necessarily what I want to be. It's just I've finally gotten used to doing it.
Yeah.
I'd much rather be the person who has everything prepared. I mean, you're good with that. Our friend Rob Virginio is good with that. I mean, these very dense, sort of prepared remarks that are not. It's not like better than worst thing at all. It's just I know how I work, and I know that if I don't know what I'm going to say, then it's chaos and it's scary. But if I know what I'm going to say, then it's a matter of hitting those beats. Mm-hmm. What happened in Denmark was that I had kind of made a point not to bring Woody in just because I knew I didn't have that much time,
right.
And I wanted to talk mostly about Jerry, basically.
Right.
But there is something there in that meaningful moment of like, what does it mean for him to create his, and this is all obvious Dylan 101 stuff, but this idea that he creates himself, he creates an identity, he's shaping himself on the run. But I don't think any of this stuff is humorous. I think it's all, I mean, some of the times he is funny with it, but I think it's all sort of making sense of himself. My grandfather grew up in rural Illinois, and he, when he was a kid, they watched all of these real life gangsters bank robbing and Dillinger, and he carved a pistol, and it's a wooden pistol that he carved out. He was probably 12 years old, and he carved the pistol out as sort of like because Dillinger had a wooden gun and used it to escape. And when he died, he lived to 95. And when he died, that was part of the eulogy I gave, was like, that was the meaningful story for me, because he did not want to be rural Illinois. And at 12 years old, he's planning an escape. And he's planning an escape by carving this gun. And that story, I think, is monumental, because then he wants to fly airplanes. So he again ends up going to Texas and learning how to fly airplanes. And he meets my grandmother, and then they get married, and he ends up flying the Berlin airlift. He goes to Korea. You know, it's all these hundreds of stories, and I'm like, well, the story is, how do you fashion your escape? Mm-hmm. And I think Dylan may not be thinking completely those terms, but he absolutely is in some ways. 1,000 miles from my home. I was born far from where I needed to be.
Right.
How many times do we have to hear about Moby Dick and the Odyssey? I mean, right. These are monumental stories. And it's like, that's the same kind of thing that I feel and felt. And it's like, well, then standing in the Nordic Museum, and then another sounds as corny as it sounds, but it was like, that was the idea, is like, I'm going to do my DNA testing. That was kind of the beginning point of it. And that DNA test, ancestry.com, that led me to understanding two things. One of which is that, a giant percentage of my background is Danish and Swedish. And the other big part is that I eventually will find
my birthmother. Which is why everyone thought you were Danish when you were there.
I will say this, that when you're traveling, you never want someone to say, what part of Texas are you from? That's no.
No, not like the woman I saw
Dallas?
In the Borough Market with her Bucky shirt on.
Your Bucky shirt. No, you don't want that. When you are on a train in Sweden and the person in Sweden's asking you for directions and you have no clue, it's still very meaning. It's like, oh, that's...
It's charming.
I love this.
Yeah.
Can you help me? I cannot help you.
I cannot. But
you know, the drunk guy from Ireland who, and I know this because he's telling me, who can't figure out the menu at the late night burger place. And he knows, he's asking me because I can. And I'm trying to tell him that I hit English. But he doesn't figure that part out. He just assumes, and he says to me, my favorite, there's these moments lately that you just freeze frame. And that was, he says, well, you're from here. And I was like, no. He's like, but you've got the hair.
That's right. I can't tell you how many times before we met up on that Tuesday in Copenhagen, I was walking around and I was like, Court? Oh, no.
It's Court? It's, like, you know, there's something to that. Anyway, all of a sudden, you're like the eighth or ninth tallest person in the room. And it's like, well, how does this ever work? And then, these moments are really important. And I think it has nothing to do with anything other than the fact of, like, you know, this sense of, like, wanting to belong or wanting to to be a part of something. And also just being, like
which goes back to connection.
It goes back to connection. It goes back to the idea when you're in a store and they're speaking English to the people in front of you and they turn and speak Danish to you and you're like, we need to go back. Take it back again, friend. And also, you know, mathematics.
You just say, tuck.
Yeah, you know, and it's like, I'd love to know, and there's a whole other discourse we could have on that. But that was very much a part of it. And so having a year of exploring that side of things, and then Denmark fits directly into that, and figuring out what I mean in all this, and then to be with friends, some of which are very close, and some of which have become very close, and through talking about Bob Dylan, it's like, well, I think that counts as transformational. So to get back to your first question, was it transformational? I believe so.
We can talk about different presentations. I mean, I think in terms of a recap of the Denmark conference, maybe we haven't done our due diligence in talking about every single thing from start to finish and who presented
what. I've explained the meta history of mine. That's about
it. No, but I think that it's important because you have, I think, expressed the sentiment and the feeling that we all expressed that last night, that people can get a sense of what it was like to be there without having us recap, you know, a chronology of what we went through, you know, of all the different presentations. They can see Rebecca's online. They can hear Laura's. I know that Kai has recordings of all of them, and we can push that out if we want to. But to kind of get the idea of what it felt like to be there, I think you have articulated that pretty well.
Well, I think that's what it was. And to have someone who I didn't know at the beginning, you know, Andrew, who kind of, I think, was he the very first?
Yeah, he opened the conference.
He opened the conference, and then
he did a great job.
Yeah, but it was funny because in 2 days, what he said the very first 20 minutes of the conference, we then had Sean Latham, who didn't close, but it was at near the end.
Yeah,
was bringing back around. It was like this kind of circle of commentary and thoughts, and we have how many people were there, and none of them had the same take. None of them were doing the same thing. Everyone had a kind of a different experiential element of it, whether it was Sean talking about the West or Grayley talking about kind of the performative issue, and then of course, you know, you've already talked about, you know, Rebecca and Laura and what they were doing. It's fascinating that no one was really saying the same stuff, but it was all resonating. And that's what a conference should be,
right?
Or a symposium should be.
And I loved that it was so small that we had the Q&A afterwards. We could all be together. We ate lunch together. We were just kind of, it was small enough that we could interact with each other in meaningful ways.
Yeah, and I think, having that time where you could speak for 20 minutes or so, whatever it is, and then have another 25, 30 minutes for discussion, you just don't have that often. And I think that's something that was meaningful. And we weren't having to bounce off of, you know, just different subjects. We were all kind of in the same subject. But yeah, then having like the walks and the sandwiches and stuff was great too.
Mm-hmm. All right, so is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Taylor Swift, continental breakfasts, garlic oil and bread? Can we talk about garlic?
I'm not gonna make.
I do want to say though, I did have the moment. Now we've talked about how I'm going to give you credit for this at large. I had a meltdown. So on the train, Court and his lovely wife Ashley and I took the train from Copenhagen to Unz, and I worked on my slides, and then we checked into the hotel, and I put my computer away, and Court and I went over to meet with Anne-Marie at the venue, which was lovely. We had that tour, and I got back to finish my slides because I was presenting on the first day right after Andrew, and my computer wouldn't turn on. And I had a meltdown. You can ask David, I cried. And my computer wouldn't go on, and I brought it down. I started to handwrite. I was going to go analog. I was trying to put something together. I was about to go home. And
Court, you were going to fly home.
I was like, I was going to leave. I was just like, I have nothing. I was having a breakdown. It was a real moment. We were working in the lobby, and I think it was before Laura got there, but I was like, I'm going to go get my computer. And I was basically doing, like, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis on the keyboard of showing you, like, it's not turning on. And he just went like this, and it went on. I don't know what mystical, magical power you have.
I am not going to take, I mean, I was there.
I'm going to take, you were
and
there
and I saw
it
that it worked.
It happened.
The funniest part of all that, when it came on, your computer came on like 15 years ago.
I know, it was like, I'm like, that's not my wallpaper.
I was like, when's the last time I've seen a screensaver like that? What is this? It was like
a toucan or
compact,
something.
Compact 1999.
And I just felt like, I went, that's not my wallpaper.
But there was a blue light that blinked, and all of a sudden it came on, and then everything sort of.
So it was just your aura that fixed it. And so that was transformative for me.
It was transformative. I would say that there is a Taylor Swift connection, that we did go see Taylor Swift in Stockholm. And
many thanks for the gifts you brought for our niece, Mackenzie.
Stolen as they were. But seeing Taylor Swift in Stockholm and watching these young people who English was probably their half, if not their first language, but their second language, certainly, singing along and crying and connecting. That was like, that was also part of this too, of like, these are people who are so deeply connected to her, and that they're seeing her, and they're playing this all out. And I think you've got to be pretty cynical not to be touched by just the spectacle of that. I mean, I know people are going, she doesn't believe, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think what she's doing right now is really cool, but it doesn't even matter. It's like when you see that, and then what I thought about was like, that was us seeing her in person, and then us going seeing Dylan in Austin.
Mm-hmm. Which I just talked about as my favorite moment, you seeing Big River.
This is a Big River, but also this idea of like, but just being that close to someone that you don't think of being close to.
Yeah.
And just physical proximity.
Did you get a bear hug?
Then you get a bear hug. But I think that's interesting, of like the idea of like, why do we do these things? Why does it matter? Why does it, Laura and I were talking just the other day about what would make you, just be honest, neither one of us seem excited. You and me and Laura don't seem all that excited about maybe the Outlaw stuff, but the new tour, summer tours, like, you know, what would make you get a ticket? What would make you make the travel plans?
I'm going to go, my uncle's going to go, and we're going up to Boston.
So you changed your tune, and now you're going to go to it. But the point being,
I get to go with Paul, and that'll be fun.
But the point being is, like, what would make it?
The people.
Oh, no. It would be like if it turns out, no.
No, but we were just talking for you, about, you're like, no. His set's only an hour and 15, so I'm wondering what the set's going to be. But that's besides the point.
But his full set isn't that much longer than, I mean, the set we've been seeing isn't that much longer. But then that was the question of, like, Laura and I were basically, what is, for her, obviously, how do you fly from the UK in?
Right.
What would make you do that?
Right.
And that's like, kind of like, you still want to see him at these particular points. Seeing him in Austin was cool, but seeing him in Austin knowing it was the final leg was important.
Right.
You were able to see many more of those shows, but it's like, well, what would make that happen? We've seen some personnel changes.
I think it's fear that it's going to be the last time I see him, for me in particular, that, you know, I want to have that experience one more time.
I don't think consciously about that, though that does come up.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like, you know, is there going to be something different? Is there going
to
be,
so it's
like,
community and fear. That's what I'm going for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that is, there's still the idea that you want to be witnessing of this. But
bring up your friend Paul Williams, who says we have to record the ephemeral moments. I think there.
What?
I don't know. I think there are a lot of little moments that were really special that, you know, either had together or with other folks that we could talk about, but out of context of the conference, they may not make sense. But is there anything else that you would like to talk about that you'd like to bring up?
You don't want to share every inside joke or,
no,
or bite of food we had that people are not going to have to.
I mean, I feel like you should mention connection. Soft Ice.
Soft Ice was good.
Yeah. I didn't believe you when you said it's the best soft serve I'd ever have. And
no, it's stupidly good.
You were right.
It's stupidly good. And then
I will never doubt you again.
There is the bread and the olive oil that I really liked. And mm-hmm. then I went back after the conference to the same place, and I was asking him.
That text was, guys, like, it happened again.
It happened again. I got it again. But I was like, man, this is so good. Where'd you get this olive oil? I thought he was going to show me some sort of secret thing. He's like, I don't know, Italy? I was like, yeah, that's pretty fair. It's not really, not everything in Denmark that's great has to be
Danish.
Although
the 7-Elevens are pretty good. Great.
Yeah, everything. Well, the thing is, and this will be my final comment, I suppose, can be wrapped up in the sense that what, in a very general way, what the Danish do, what the Swedish do, in the very limited way I've seen it, but I do connect to this, is that what they care about, what they seem to care about, I mean, there is an element there where they just have a lot of things better than us in terms of education and healthcare and societal, community-based areas and parks and yes, and bicycle, yeah, of course. But beyond that, what they tend to care about are the things that make life kind of delightful. And it's like, you know, you're going to go into a place and they're going to have lit candles. You're going to go into a place like our breakfast at the hotel, and they're just going to have a beautiful loaf of bread with a towel on it. And if you had that at the Hampton Inn here, it'd be in someone's backpack at 6:30.
The cheese wheel.
I mean, these are all things that we could talk immensely about, but I think there's something to that. Like, every place is like, well, these are the things that kind of give life sort of a little bit of meaning.
If I may interrupt, even the Starbucks, my stomach is bothering me, so I went into a Starbucks because it was familiar. Otherwise, I wouldn't have. And they said, is that for here to take away? And I said, it's for here. And I got a cup with a saucer.
Yeah, the ceramic saucers.
And it was just like, yeah. At a Starbucks that you would never get here. And it was lovely.
And again, I think I've traveled enough, and you've certainly traveled enough, mm-hmm. that this is not like a romantic sort of vision of like, oh. But it's also like, you know, there's the things that I really think matter. And those things cohere directly with kind of the way they run things over there. And like, I went to the Louisiana Museum, and then it's the same kind of thing. Their museum bistro was like, you know, as high end as you can imagine, but not in terms of like, yes, in terms of the presentation and stuff, but it was just like, you know, they care about that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking in general terms, but I think it bears out. And I think that there is something about being in an area and in a place that, does have an elevated sense of what is enjoyable and what is normative. Mm-hmm. That is very shocking when you come back to the inflatable.
It feels luxurious, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Decadent, almost.
Yeah, and I, you know, we both can go different directions with this. And right. But there is an element of like, when you were showing me the, what was it, the Statue of Liberty? In the Newark airport, was that Newark?
No, it was Toronto.
Toronto.
Yeah.
And it was like a.
There's a, that
used
rope.
Car lot.
That rope, and then you said that something about the rope keeping you away.
The metaphor of not touching the Statue of Liberty. Yeah, that, yeah. Yeah. There's something to that, and it's like, you know, just anyway. I won't go further down this road, other than to say that it was a really delightful experience to engage people in a way that we just don't do as well here on a normative level because of just the
pace, I think, right? Or just...
Oh, there's 10,000 reasons for it, but yeah. I think there is, certainly now more than ever, there's an increased sense of tension and an increased sense of anxiety because the basic questions are not so clear. And you're in an area and in a country and a series of countries where those things are just not nearly as chaotic a question, that they've solved those questions.
Right.
And so young people and old people can go out and bicycle and have a beer and enjoy their lives, not worrying about, you know, the hustle or the grind to
make sure they can get something together the next day. Right. And we're speaking very romantic generalities. I understand that. But it was just really lovely. And it was like, you know, it's also like Seattle in the sense that you have like 3 hours of golden hour. So it's like, you know, the sun doesn't really ever set. So in this part of the year, you know, the sun sets like at 10:30 or whatever it is. And it comes up again at 4. Mm-hmm. I have a whole Substack I'm planning on my connection to the sun. Y'all are going to love it.
We will also link that in the show notes.
Tell us more about your views on the fucking sun. Like, what can you say? Can you say more about this? Oh, really? You have profound,
with a very short intimate, note on taking pictures of the full moon.
Yeah. You're not going to capture it. You're not going to get it, but you're gonna feel it. So, yes, that's my two cents divided by 7. That you'd have to do on the fly repeatedly in Denmark.
Is it in krona or is
which
it?
Is that?
84,000 krona, sure. That sounds reasonable.
Next time I get Wi-Fi, I'll find out what that is.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
This was great, and I want to thank you for letting me to recap no part of what I talked about or what we talked about other than vibes.
Well, I think
the vibes were good.
I think if people get the vibe, then they get the conference, right?
And they'll want to go back.
Yeah.
And we'll have more on that probably that they can read or see shortly, maybe, right?
I think so.
Maybe.
Well, we're going to have, Paul Haney's going to put out, I think in the fall, winter, Dylan Review. Our papers will be in that. And then, as I said, I think Kai has all of the recordings, so we can push those out probably.
Do we need those?
We might.
Would you listen to yourself, David?
Never.
I can't. With the Dylan taunts.
I would listen to all of you, but
for
not
the Dylan taunts, I go ahead and I hear the first time I say something, if it doesn't sound like a monster voice, then I was like, good enough.
Yep,
I can't imagine what else I said that was just wildly inappropriate. Yeah.
It's all great.
All right.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we will have you back shortly because you're going to talk about your book on Nathan Bedford.
None of this. We'll talk about something very different.
Yeah,
how that
yeah.
connects to Bob Dylan.
It'll be great. I'm looking forward to that.
Does.
And Dylan and history and stuff like that. That'll
yes.
be fantastic.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me in your home.
This is not my home. Thank you very much for watching and stay tuned for the next episode of Infinity Goes Up on Trial that drops the first of each month. Bye, guys.